Today's episode of the Can Be Now podcast is brought to you by Gustafson Insurance, business, home, and auto insurance made simple. For a free quote, call 503-266-2216. This episode is also brought to you by Odd Mo's Pizza in Canby. Handmade, awesome pizza, as well as craft beer and cider, delivered. Call them today at 503-266-8444.
This tax exemption eludes me like a gazelle eludes an arthritic cat.
Why can't Canby people keep track of their dogs? Like, what is...
To do that, you can't be stupid with guns.
Yeah. Set the board is saying they want to make Canby schools great again.
It feels like we've been doing this interview for years.
Inside of me was screaming.
You run for school board, you win or you die.
There's no second place.
Welcome to the Can Be Now podcast.
We are the best and easiest way to stay connected to what's happening in your hometown. I'm Tyler Frankie.
I'm James Walton.
And I'm Tyler Clausen.
The Canby business community does not want to see the city and the school district give up on the Ackerman Recreation Complex, at least not yet. On several occasions, the city has discussed a proposed complex of multi-use sports fields and courts behind Lee Elementary and the Ackerman Center, with the possibility of also redeveloping Ackerman itself into some sort of community center. The plans were to include baseball, softball, rugby, soccer, football, and lacrosse fields, basketball, tennis, and pickleball courts, along with a pedestrian walking trail. The city even hired a consultant to develop some initial design concepts and estimate potential costs. And that's where the project lost some of its steam when the price tag came back much higher than officials expected, $13 to $14 million. Those who support the project have by no means abandoned the idea, but it's simply not clear where such a large sum of money might come from. It could be included in a bond package that the school district may present next year, but a survey of likely voters last month indicated that might not be a good idea. Those surveyed did like the idea of the sports complex, but they liked it much less than almost every other item that could be included in the package, such as technology and safety upgrades. And if the sports complex were included in the bond package, it would push the overall price tag upwards of $90 million, something the majority of respondents said they would vote against. However, the board of directors of the Canby Area Chamber of Commerce had a simple message for both the city and the school district, delivered last week by Director Kyle Lang. Keep trying.
So there's many reasons that we believe this project would be good for our community, not just on the level of the citizen having access to a variety of different services, right? When we're talking phase one, just the fields and kind of moving on to phase two, community center kind of campus concept. I think it will serve the needs of the community in multiple different ways, but also for the needs of the local businesses. Specifically, our hospitality and retail businesses are huge advocates for any type of project that brings in additional capacity to host tournaments, to host events, that brings outside dollars into the community.
The business community getting behind youth sports is not really anything new for Canby. One of the more visible examples came in 2010 when a grassroots effort led primarily by local businesses raised almost $1 million to install the artificial turf football field at Canby High School, but there have also been many others. But Lang said that there are also pragmatic reasons for business owners to support this project, including the possibility that it could help attract new companies to Canby.
But we also think that there's secondary benefits that happen with having a facility of this nature. I think livability plays a lot into a project of this nature. Companies don't just look for cheap dirt to land their businesses on. They look for communities that are livable, that employees would want to live in, work in.
Lang concluded by encouraging the city council and school board to, quote, come to the table in a good faith effort to realize the ambitious project. It's certainly an appropriate message with the holidays just around the corner and all. Hey, you never know. A miracle just might happen. Residents got their first look this week at what the revamped interchange at the Aurora-Donald exit of Interstate 5 could look like. Oregon Department of Transportation officials presented their tentative plans to the city councils of both Aurora and Donald, and also held an open house and stakeholders meeting Wednesday at North Marion High School. The existing interchange was built 60 years ago and was designed to handle the traffic of that day when the closest neighbors were a handful of quiet farms. Today is the access point for three large truck stops, as well as an RV park, and sees approximately 32,000 vehicles each day. ODOT officials admit the interchange has been over capacity at peak times for many years. The project summary puts it this way, quote, "It has significant safety issues and does not operate like a busy interchange should." The project is in its preliminary stages, with engineers documenting the current traffic volumes, interchange performance, and desired levels of service. Officials don't want to wind up in the same situation they're in now, where the new interchange is at capacity almost as soon as it opens. They want the revamped exit to be able to handle current traffic levels as well as future growth. The leading concept for the new interchange would utilize what's called a diverging diamond interchange. Originally pioneered in France, this unusual design actually requires overpass traffic to briefly switch over to the wrong side of the road. The upside is that it greatly improves safety by eliminating the need for left turns. It's not quite as confusing as it may sound. ODOT previously used the design in 2016 at the Fern Valley I-5 interchange in Southern Oregon. You can see video of that on our website at cambynowpod.com. The design phase is planned for next year, with a bid letting in 2021 and construction for the first phase of the project in 2022. The project has currently been allocated a total of $28.3 million, most of it coming from House Bill 217, the so-called Keep Oregon Moving package. A $28 million price tag certainly seems like a lot, but not when it comes to highway projects. This would only carry the project through design and phase one. ODOT says funding is not currently available for construction of a full interchange. The Clackamas County Board of Commissioners approved this week a slate of transportation project using revenue from the county's new vehicle registration fee, and a Canby area project will be one of the first ones funded. The project will reconstruct and add turn lanes to the intersection of the Canby-Markham Highway and Lone Elder Road. An advisory committee made up of 15 community members ranked this intersection as the number two highest priority project in the county, second only to widening of Johnson Creek Boulevard between 55th Avenue and Bell. The Board of Commissioners approved the committee's recommendations for congestion relief projects on Tuesday, along with recommendations from other advisory groups for safety improvement and repaving projects. The Citizen Committee was charged with prioritizing potential projects that could be completed in the next 8 to 9 years. They were asked to spread projects throughout the county, leverage other funding sources, and wherever possible, overlap congestion relief needs with safety and paving projects. According to Commissioner Kim Humberston, they did an outstanding job.
I read through this, and the thing that impressed me the most was the global thinking as opposed to parochial thinking on the committee's part. Really looked at the big picture. I just thought they did an outstanding job, quite frankly. It's a good example of how, when we get community involvement on projects and their thoughts on things, that we sometimes can do a better job than just trying to do it all ourselves.
In addition to Johnson Creek and Canby-Markham Highway, there are projects coming to several other rural county roads, including Stafford, Redland, Childs, Welch's, and Amsiger. Commissioner Paul Savas said that while most people tend to see congestion as an urban problem, it's just as common, and if not more so, in the country.
The concept of congestion, a lot of people jump to the fact that they, or not the fact, but I think the general understanding that congestion is in the urban area and on the urban arterials. And as we all know, our local old farm roads are now highly congested. And I think people don't understand that reality. And not having shoulders or sidewalks, and the car accidents that happen are far more severe in that situation that would be otherwise.
Commissioners also approved initial project scoping and other preliminary work to provide congestion relief at the intersection of Highway 99E and Barlow Road west of Canby. These projects will be funded through revenue from the new countywide vehicle registration fee that commissioners approved in February 2019. The fee will go into effect in January 2020. A 40% share of the revenue will also go to the cities based on population. The county expects to start construction on the highest priority projects this summer. Accidental overdoses happen. Naloxone saves lives. Talk with your doctor or pharmacist about naloxone. These are the messages that will appear on billboards at various locations around busy highways in Clackamas County over the next 3 weeks. Naloxone is a medication designed to rapidly reverse the effects of an opioid overdose and can save someone's life, according to the Clackamas County Public Health Division. Opioids include prescription medications such as codeine, fentanyl, hydrocodone, hydromorphone, and methadone. Anyone of any age who takes too much of an opioid medication could experience an overdose, which could be deadly. April Heron, a program coordinator for the county's public health division and co-organizer of the local naloxone work group, says that we, as a community, need to change the way we think about opioid addiction. Addiction can touch anyone's life, and it often starts with a prescription, she said. It's time we stop viewing opioid addiction as a moral failing, but instead as a chronic but treatable disease. Abigail Wells, who is the Prevention and Community Public Health Department Manager for the Northwest Family Services and the other co-organizer of the work group, believes that breaking the stigma associated with drug reuse is the biggest challenge faced in fighting the opioid crisis. We have all dehumanized opioid abusers over the years, largely due to ignorance around addiction and all the complications that go with it, she said. We look at substance use very differently as a society than any other medical conditions. The Naloxone Work Group is tackling the issues of opioid addiction, stigma, overdose, and naloxone rescue in a number of ways, including making naloxone available at at-risk populations and to those who are most likely to encounter an overdose situation, such as law enforcement, community organizations, and pharmacies. Learn more at www.tricountyopioidsafety.org. While Canby and many other communities were gathering to honor, remember, and celebrate our nation's veterans, firefighters were responding to a two-alarm fire that broke out at the Metro South Transfer Station in Oregon City. The fire was reported shortly after noon. The first crews on the scene reported a 400-square-foot area of garbage burning in Bay 1 of the facility, with approximately 15 employees and 20 customers being evacuated. No injuries were reported. Hose lines were quickly deployed and the sprinkler system was supported to extinguish the fire and kept it from spreading to the building. A second alarm was called due to the potential for fire spread. However, the fire was brought under control in 40 minutes and the second alarm units were canceled. The cause of the fire is undetermined, according to Clackamas Fire.
It's Police Beat for the week of October 8th through the 14th. On October 8th at 1:37 a.m., a traffic stop was attempted on a vehicle that failed to stop at a stop sign. Although the vehicle eluded officers at the time, officers located the vehicle in a neighboring city. Because, see, they work together. You can't elude the law. Okay, never mind. 7:30 a.m., report of a hit and run to property damage overnight when an unknown person drove a vehicle into a fence. What they had against that fence, we'll never know, but someone's got to fix the fence. At 8:49 p.m., report of an unknown person entering and rummaging through two unlocked vehicles overnight, but no items were reported missing. On October 10th at 10:46 a.m., report of a theft of an unlocked vehicle sometime within the previous 5 days. So that's cool. At 6:03 p.m., a woman was arrested in the parking lot of a store for violating a restraining order. And then 2 hours later at 8:15, officers took a man into custody for violating a restraining order. So apparently October 10th was the day of violating restraining orders. On October 12th at 10 a.m., an officer responded to assist an injured dog. The officer wrapped the dog and transported the animal to the veterinarian clinic for treatment. That officer is now my hero, and I love him. Also the puppy. But that's a personal thing. I probably shouldn't bring that onto the podcast. At 11:50 p.m., an uninsured vehicle being driven by a suspended driver was stopped, and the vehicle was impounded. Because obviously. On October 13th at 1:49 a.m., an officer attempted to stop a vehicle traveling 105 miles per hour in a 35-mile-an-hour speeding zone. Following a short pursuit, the driver, who was on parole, was arrested for DUI, alcohol, reckless driving, and attempt to elude. I mean, that was on Sequoia Parkway. That's nuts. Why would you do 105? Whatever. At 9:20 p.m., officers responded to a witness report of a male and female engaged in physical altercation near a fuel station. Both intoxicated individuals were arrested on probation violation detainers and for disorderly conduct. And finally, on October 14th at 1:48 p.m., an uninsured vehicle was stopped and the driver was arrested for DUI, alcohol, possession of cocaine, and carrying a concealed weapon. Because why? Why would you go drunk driving without your cocaine on you? Of course you have to have that on you.
Are you a small business owner or maybe thinking of investing in yourself with your very own startup? Awesome! Now all you have to do is reach potential customers at a time when consumers have never been more fragmented, more distracted, or more difficult to reach. If that sounds hard, believe me, it is. That's why I make Frankie do it.
Carrie and her team at Promotional Strategies offer strategic, purposeful solutions to build your brand with lasting promotional items that make sense for you and your company. They are creative geniuses who will deliver advertisements that people actually thank you for and will use every day. We've tried other sellers, and we trust Carrie to provide high-quality branded items that we can be proud of. Find them at 695 Southeast 1st Avenue in Canby or online at ps266swag.com. Hey, Tyler.
Yeah?
Can you do me a favor? Just real quick, name all the services that you're subscribed to.
Okay. Netflix, Amazon Prime, Hulu. There's like Google stuff, I think. My wife, I think, does a cat thing, and I'm looking into Dollar Shave Club.
It's starting to get a little ridiculous, right? There's even an app to manage all of your subscriptions now. Of course, it comes with its own monthly convenience fee. It can get a little overwhelming. They've even coined a term for it, subscription fatigue.
If you're being hit with subscription fatigue blues, we have a solution for you, at least when it comes to streaming options. Try Easy Video TV from Direct Link. It offers your favorite shows and movies all in one app on the same bill as your internet service.
Direct Link is a local community-based provider that has your back. Record your favorite shows, watch them anywhere, and access all the major local and cable TV networks with an Easy Video subscription.
Why are we still sitting here? How do I sign up? Let's go!
Well, it's easy. Just call DirectLink at 503-266-8111, visit their office at Juniper and 2nd, or go to directlink.coop to switch to Easy Video TV today. Welcome back, listeners. My guest on the Canby Conversation today, I'm very excited about. He's a local sports legend. He's a legend in the sport of wrestling on the national stage. He's a Canby High School graduate, was a national champion wrestler in 1970, and recently inducted into the Oregon chapter of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. He's a wrestling coach at Woodburn High School. It's Larry Owings. Hi, Larry.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for being on the Canby Now podcast.
You're welcome.
Well, we have, for folks that don't know, quite a story to tell about you and your experiences in wrestling, but let's start right here in Canby. You grew up here, went to Canby High School, wrestled in high school. Tell us a little bit just about growing up and what your high school years were like as far as wrestling goes.
Well, I actually grew up in the 91 school area, which is part of the Canby School District, but after the 8th grade, I did go to Canby High School, and my older brothers were all state wrestling champions.
Okay.
And I was the youngest of all the boys.
By how much?
Well, my oldest brother graduated in 1954.
Okay.
And I graduated in 1968.
Right, yeah.
So that's a few years between us.
Right.
And then I had a brother that graduated in 56, and then one that graduated in 62. And another one that graduated in 65.
So people were just waiting another great wrestler to come along.
That was it. And, you know, I was the last of the bunch.
Uh-huh.
And they all said I would never be a wrestler.
Oh, really?
Yeah. When I was younger, I was really pretty fat. and my nickname was Porky. And everybody called me that, you know, teachers at school, you know, friends. And
that is so mean.
I know. And
your
I tell you,
your teachers called you Porky?
Everybody did.
Oh, my word.
They made up songs about me and teased me unmercifully.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
I can't tell you the pain that I went through as
yeah.
a kid.
Oh, for sure.
Nobody should have to go through that.
No, that's awful.
But, you know, maybe that's the reason I ended up being so tough, I guess.
And I am sorry for laughing.
It really toughened me up.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's okay. I can deal with it now.
Yeah.
But at the time, you know, it was pretty tough because
sure.
back then, you know, we didn't know anything about weight control or dieting or anything like that, you know. And it was kind of like everybody just sat down at the table and we all ate and that was it.
Right.
So, at any rate, I went to work for an old Norwegian dairy farmer between the 7th and 8th grade, and just ran me to death. I hauled hay all summer long, and we ran, and I lost about 25, 30 pounds, and I grew at the same time. And so by the time I got to high school, I was about 20 pounds lighter than I was in the 5th grade.
Uh-huh.
And then I started wrestling my first year. Larry Wright was my wrestling coach, great man. He's passed away now, but
he was a local legend in his own right.
He was a local legend, absolutely one of the best high school and college coaches around. But at any rate, Larry Wright was my coach, and I started wrestling, and I did okay freshman and JV matches, and I kept challenging for the varsity slot. And finally, one day, I beat the varsity guy, and I got to be the varsity wrestler. And I was, oh, man, I was on seventh heaven.
So there's just one per weight class? Is that how it worked?
Yeah, there's one varsity wrestler.
Oh, okay.
And then there's a junior varsity wrestler and maybe several junior varsity wrestlers and then maybe a freshman wrestler, too.
Gotcha.
But at any rate, so I challenged, and I became the varsity guy. Well, the guy that I had to wrestle was from Silverton High School. And his name was Donnie Roth, and Donnie Roth was a third in state champion, third in state, the year before.
Mm.
And he turned me every way but loose and finally pinned me in the second round. And I was absolutely devastated.
Yeah, first match.
Every confidence that I, all the confidence that I'd built up to that point was just completely destroyed.
Yeah.
And I ended up, make a long story short, I wrestled 5 varsity matches that year. And after every match, you know, or every match that I wrestled, I should say, I just kind of didn't go out and wrestle. I didn't think that I could win. You know, I thought that I was going to get beat, and I ended up getting beat.
Yeah.
And wrestling is about 95% mental.
Sure.
So if you don't think you can do it,
probably not,
you're going to have a hard time.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's one of the things that I've maintained. It's one of the I've got 3 different things that I think are very important in life. And one of them is believe in yourself. Mm-hmm. Believe you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have it at that point. Any rate, my last match that I wrestled that year, I really stunk up the mat bad. My coach asked me, says, "What's the matter, Larry? Are you sick or something? I mean, you're not wrestling like you should be wrestling."
Yeah.
And so I went home and kind of thought about that. You know, my coach thinks I'm a better wrestler than what I'm showing. And so at any rate, there was a tournament after the regular high school competition was over. They had an open tournament they called the Open Freestyle and Open Greco-Roman Tournament.
Mm-hmm.
There was 2 tournaments. I entered the Open Greco-Roman Tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And I went out against my first match, and I looked at the kid, and every one of my high school matches that I wrestled was varsity was freshman or JV. I won.
Mm-hmm.
Never had a problem.
Yeah.
And I looked across the mat, and I saw this guy, and I thought, he looks like a JV guy.
Yeah.
And anybody could enter, so how do I know whether he's a JV or what?
Right.
So I wrestling went out there, and I thought, yeah, I can beat this guy. So I went out, and I pinned him. And I came off the mat, and Larry Wright, my coach, slapped me on the back. He says, "You knew who that guy was?" And I go, "No." And he says, "That guy just got second in state this year."
Wow.
And I go, "Wow." He said, "You just beat a guy that got second in state."
Yeah.
And, you know, that kind of bumped my confidence back up a little bit, you know. And so then I had to wrestle my next match, and the same thing happened. I looked at this guy, and he looked like he wasn't very tough.
Yeah.
And I thought I could beat him, and so I went out and wrestled him, and I pinned him also. And I came off the mat, and Coach Larry slapped me on the back and said, that guy got second in state in a different weight class this year. He said, you just pinned two guys who got second in state.
Huh.
So my confidence went up a little bit more. So I wrestled my third match, and the exact same thing happened. I came off the mat. My coach slapped me on the back and said, that guy got second in state, too, in a different division, you know, A1 or A2 or whatever. And so, you know, and to this day, right. I don't know if he was lying to me or telling me the truth or
just
what.
Just an incredible coincidence.
But at any rate, it's immaterial now because I realize now that the problem that I had wasn't that I was a terrible wrestler. It's that I didn't believe I could do it.
Yeah.
I didn't have faith in myself.
Yeah.
So whoever's listening out there, you know, that's one of the number one things you have to have is a belief that you can do it. Mm-hmm. You can do anything that anybody else can do. The only difference between you and somebody else is the fact that they may know how to do it.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that you can't learn how to do it.
Yeah.
And so you always want to believe that you can do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So any rate, so that's the number one thing. Number two thing is you never want to quit. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm always a believer that you're never beaten unless you quit. Mm-hmm. And so just keep trying, keep trying, keep trying. It's like maybe you didn't have enough time. Maybe you didn't have enough experience. Maybe you didn't have enough confidence.
Yeah.
But eventually, if you never quit, you'll get to that point where you will have all of those things.
Yeah.
And it's real important. And it's the little things that really make the difference, you know. If you take a tree root growing underneath concrete, you know, if you tried, you've probably seen the cracks that a tree root does to the concrete sidewalks and stuff like that.
Sure, I mean, not here in Canby, of course, but maybe some other cities don't.
But any place, you know. If you tried to measure the force that root is exerting on the concrete, you can't measure it.
Yeah.
There's no force there.
Right.
But over a period of time,
that
root is able to crack that concrete. That strong concrete gets beaten by a little tiny root.
Yeah.
And that's what's real important when you're doing things is little efforts over a long period of time. You know, a little bit here, a little bit there. It'll amount to a lot eventually.
Absolutely.
You know, you'll be able to accomplish whatever you need to do. Each time you do something, you're going to do it a little bit better. Mm. And that's real important.
That's some great wisdom.
Yeah. And then the third thing that I've always believed, too, is that it's real important to look around yourself and look for ways to help other people. You know, there was, and I learned this lesson by a story from the state fair. This corn farmer from Brooks, and I don't remember his name. I read the article, but anyway, he every year at the state fair, he would win first prize in the corn growing contest. He'd bring in the best corn, and he'd always get first prize. And so they finally, after years of this happening, they finally went to him and said, how is it that you can have the very best corn year after year after year?
Yeah.
And he said, well, he says, it's real simple. He says, first thing you do, he says, you find the very best corn seed that you can find. Mm-hmm. And he says, then you go out and you give the corn seed to everybody around you that has farms, that is a farmer, mm-hmm. you know, and you save just enough to plant your own field. He said, all of the pollen from these neighboring fields comes in and pollinates my corn, and my corn ends up being the very, very best.
Wow.
And I thought about that, and I thought, you know, you surround yourself with the best people, and you help your neighbors to become their very best. So I thought, how does that apply to wrestling? Mm. And I thought, well, you know, if you're wrestling somebody, if you're taking him down with a certain move, or you're turning him over and pinning him with a certain move, tell him what you're doing.
Yeah.
That's going to make him a better wrestler. Now, because he's a better wrestler, now what do you have to do? Mm. Well, you have to become a better wrestler. You have to learn something new in order to wrestle against this kid that maybe before you beat real easily, and now all of a sudden he's able to counter what you've been doing. And so it makes you a better wrestler. So you help those around you, and it always comes back to help you.
Yeah.
So that's those awesome. Are three keys in my life that I try to live by.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I love that story about the corn farmer. I'm going to have to remember that. That's quite a metaphor that's not just applicable in wrestling, but a lot of avenues. So, interestingly, of course, and we didn't mention this in the intro because I don't feel that it's necessarily fair to you to define you around this, but of course a lot of people do kind of anyway. We'll talk about that a little bit, but you're most known for a match when you won the national championship in 1970 against a wrestler who didn't necessarily need tips from you in that way. He was already quite accomplished. Dan Gable, known even now 50 years later as probably the greatest wrestler the amateur wrestling has ever seen. At that time, he was a three-time champion.
He was a two-time national champion, NCAA champion,
right.
And he was 180 wins in a row.
Right, right. Had never lost.
Never
a match
lost
in college or high school. After this championship that we're going to talk about, never lost again. He went on to have an international career in wrestling, was in the Olympics, where he not only won every match, but didn't give up a single point.
That's great.
He was he was a legend. He's almost superhuman, considered that by many people and many observers. And, before we turned on the mics and started talking here, we were looking at a really cool locally made documentary that had some archival footage of the match. And Dan Gable, if you've never seen him, back then, he was a college kid, but he looks like Chris Hemsworth from Thor. He's incredible. He's handsome. He's got this incredible body and arms. He just had that look. In old newspaper articles, people called him the glamour boy. He had it all. Were you you had met him before this match, right?
So yeah, I wrestled him once in high school. I was a high school senior and thought I was pretty tough. And maybe I was, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I won the Olympic Regional Tournament and qualified to go back to the National Tournament.
Right.
And so I went back to the National Tournament. I was lucky enough to get some of the local organizations around here to help sponsor me go back because I didn't have any money, I wouldn't have been able to go back any other way. But went back there, and the first match that I drew was Dan Gable. And he was already a national champion in college.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know anything about wrestling or not, but you try to compare a high school wrestler to a college national champion, there's a big difference.
Yeah,
big difference. Anyway, I wrestled Dan Gable, and I ended up putting him on his back during the match, but he ended up outscoring me, and he beat me 9-4, I think, or 9-5. I'm not sure exactly what, but it was...
We'll say 9-5.
Yeah, that sounds better. But anyway, so I lost to him. And then my second match in the tournament, I wrestled a guy by the name of Tom Huff, who was a two-time national champion from Colorado Springs. And
it's a lucky draw for you.
Yeah, it's a lucky draw. He beat me 6-4.
Yeah.
And I went back to the back to Canby with my tail between my legs, and I thought, wow, this college is pretty tough. I didn't know that I drew probably the two toughest guys in the whole nation.
Well, yeah, you just had this luck of, like that first high school tournament where you got three number two finishers in the state right in a row.
So. Yeah. So, at any rate, it was a good lesson for me and kind of knocked my confidence down a little bit. Well, I don't want to say knocked my confidence down, but it made me realize that I have to work a lot harder if I was going to be a national champion.
Yeah, yeah. So you went to college at University of Idaho.
University of Washington.
He was Idaho. Dan Gable's Idaho, right?
No, Dan Gable was Iowa.
Iowa, excuse me.
Okay. Iowa State.
Okay. So you went on to college at the University of Washington.
Correct.
And you were, I believe, a sophomore in 1970?
In 1970, I was a sophomore, yes.
Yeah. So tell us about the first, as a freshman on the wrestling team, you were in a different weight class from Dan Gable, right?
Well, back in that time, freshmen could wrestle on the national level. However, they couldn't wrestle varsity in the Pac-8.
Oh, okay.
So I was relegated to just wrestling JVs and freshman matches, junior college matches and stuff like that. I couldn't wrestle on the varsity team because I was ineligible. Freshmen were ineligible for that. But I was eligible for the NCAA tournament. Mm-hmm. And so I wrestled all year long, I think at 150, 158, and I won all my matches. And then I was able to challenge our varsity guys on the Washington team and make the varsity team. So I challenged at 115 and beat the guy there. So I could have gone at 150, and I thought, well, that's too much weight for me, so I cut down.
Yeah.
Then the next weight down was 145, and I beat the guy there. I could have gone that. And I thought, no, I think I better go one more weight lower. Mm-hmm. And the next weight down was 137, and I beat the guy there. And then I come to the strange realization that Dan Gable was at 137 pounds. Mm. And I thought, you know, I don't think I'm quite ready for him. You know, I'm going to have to cut another weight class.
Yeah.
So I cut down to 130 pounds.
Oh, okay.
And I wrestled at the national tournament there at 130 pounds. I won three matches. And then I lost my fourth match. And back then, if the guy that beat you lost his next match, you were out of the tournament.
Oh.
Since then, they've made it double elimination so that you can lose one and then you get put back in and you can come through. Because I actually had a fifth place seed in the tournament. Dale Thomas, the coach at Oregon State, argued for a fifth seed for me because I'd beaten so many guys that were really, really good.
Yeah.
And he knew that I was tough. And I ended up being exactly in a fifth seed place.
Yeah.
And back then, if you were in fifth seed place, you got beat by the guy that got third, and then you got put out of the tournament. Yeah. So you could never place fifth.
Yeah.
So at any rate, they've changed that now, and so now you're able to place like you're supposed to be able to.
Sure.
So at any rate, so I didn't place at all in the NCAA that year.
Disappointment.
And then after that season was over, they had a national freestyle and national Greco-Roman tournaments, and I went to those. And instead of going 130 pounds, I jumped up a couple weight classes. I went at 149 and a half pounds. I wrestled in the National Greco-Roman Tournament, and I became the champion at 149 and a half pounds. In the finals, I wrestled a guy from Japan. It was by the name of Hattori, I believe is his name, who had, I believe he was the fifth in the World Games that year.
Wow.
And I ended up pinning him in the finals. And then in the freestyle tournament, I wrestled through that, and I beat everybody in that tournament, too. I think I pinned everybody but one person in that tournament, and I got the most falls trophy for that. So I won two national championships, one in freestyle and one in Greco-Roman, and was the outstanding wrestler in one of those tournaments and had the most falls in the other tournament.
A little bit of a confidence builder there.
Yeah, so then that finished up my freshman year.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was on to the sophomore year.
On to the sophomore year.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from the sponsors who make this show possible. When we return, more of the incredible true story of Larry Owings and Dan Gable and the match that made sports history.
Hey Tyler, did you know that the world has changed in the past 20 years?
No way!
Yep, it's true. The way people shop for goods and services has completely changed since this thing called the internet started catching on.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
And yet some realtors still offer the same old services in the same old ways and for the same old percentages. Victory Point Property Group in Canby believes it's time the real estate business caught up with the times. They'll meet with you for free, explain every step of the process, give you a clear game plan, and even let you choose the listing commission.
Really? They let you choose their commission?
Really? Victory Point Property Group understands this is one of the biggest and most exciting decisions of your life, and they'll do everything they can to make sure you handle it like a rock star.
Wow, that sounds great. I'm going to check them out by calling 503-263-4700 or by visiting online at victorypointhomes.com.
You do that. Victory Point Property Group, real estate reimagined.
I am not a golfer.
I mean, I'm not a good golfer. So when I want to play a few rounds, I head over to Frontier Golf Course. They're family-owned, family-friendly nine-hole course with beautiful scenery. And they let me rent clubs or bring my own. And they don't judge me for my slices and hacks. Or, you know, my language.
Frontier Golf Course is a great place to meet your buddies and have a drink or bring your kids along. They're located on Holly Street just north of town. If you hit the ferry, you've gone too far.
Also, please don't hit the ferry.
Yeah, please don't. But do ask them about Farley the Goat. They love that. Frontier prides itself on being the best value course you'll find in the area. If you haven't been by in a while, you've got to come check out what the new owners have done. Frontier Golf Course, it's a new frontier.
On to the sophomore year.
On to the sophomore year, and you knew, I guess, coming in that if you wanted another crack at Dan Gable, this was going to be the last chance because it was his senior year, so he was going to be moving out of the college circuit.
That's correct. Dan Gable was a senior. He had won the national tournament 2 years in a row and was the outstanding wrestler, I believe, both of those years.
Sure.
Maybe it was just 1 year, but he was a phenomenal wrestler.
Right.
Best in the nation, right, as far as anybody was concerned.
And, I mean, I can't overstate, like, I've read newspaper, famous across the country as a college wrestler. I mean, college wrestling isn't necessarily what it was then, but it was a household name, was Dan Gable.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, if you can imagine winning 180 matches in a row and never losing a match.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people would do kind of what you did freshman year. You know, they would try to avoid Dan Gable. They would try to, like, you know, not be in his weight class. So by the time, you know, he had such a reputation. But you were doing the opposite. You were kind of gunning for him a little bit. You wanted another crack at him.
I wrestled at 158 pounds that year on our team all year long, mm-hmm, because that's where the coach needed me. And I was the Pac-8 champion at 158 pounds. Mm-hmm. Wrestled Kim Snyder, another Camby boy.
Yeah, cool.
In the finals, and I beat Kim 12-5. Kim was a great wrestler. He ended up, I think, third in the NCAA at 158 pounds.
Cool. Shout out
to
Kim Snyder.
Great wrestler.
Yeah.
And he was a state freestyle champion for Camby High School also.
Oh, cool.
But at any rate, I was wrestling heavier than what I should have been. So I knew the year before I cut to 130, and that was too much for me. So this year, they had changed the weight classes, and so the weight class that I thought was the very best for me was 141 pounds. Mm-hmm. And again, we found out that Dan Gable was going to be there. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of like, well, I avoided him the year before, and so this year, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
We're going to go right full steam straight ahead and see what we can do.
Yeah.
And
One thing about Dan Gable, obviously, you know, he had the physique. He had talent. From things that I've read, he was very cerebral in his approach to wrestling. He would, you know, really study. He knew, he knew his opponents. He knew their strengths, the moves they like to use, the best way to, you know, he would kind of approach it in that way. But he was most famous, I think, for his conditioning. I mean, it was almost legendary. He would wake up in the middle of the night and do push-ups just because it motivated him to know that his opponents were sleeping at the time that he was working out. I believe, and from what I've read, Larry, in preparation, you try to match his conditioning or even do better.
I never woke up in the middle of the night and did push-ups. No, I didn't do that. I think I did the regular workouts during wrestling practice, you know.
Okay.
And then I did running every day outside of that. I would run usually about 3 miles a day in the mornings to kind of split it up a little bit. And then I had a weightlifting class that same year that I was in, and I also was in a gymnastics class, so I got physical exercise out of both those too, so I was getting quite a bit of physical exercise, yes.
Yeah. Well, okay, so tell us about the tournament.
You mean the
1970?
Well,
Dan Gable was...
Dan Gable's undefeated.
Looking to finish out his career undefeated.
He was going to finish out his college career at 181-0.
Yeah, yeah.
And the only thing that stood between that was me. I was the only guy. But it was interesting. Dan Gable pinned everybody on his side of the racket all the way to the finals.
Yeah, yeah.
And I pinned everybody on my side of the racket all the way through to the finals, too. Yeah. So it was kind of a real showdown.
Right. And also, I want to say, because, you know, because it became known and to sports writers and things that you had dropped your weight class for a chance at Dan Gable, you were called either the bravest or the smartest guy in wrestling, something.
Yeah,
of
that sort. I dropped two weight classes.
Two weight classes, yeah.
And I was either the dumbest or the bravest guy in the world. And there were all kinds of stories going around there that, you know, I had come back there specifically to beat Dan Gable. And I don't think it was, I mean, I knew Dan Gable was there, but, and I wanted to beat him, yes, and I believed that I could beat him, but if Dan Gable had been in a different weight class, I would still probably have been at 141, because I thought that was my best weight class.
Yeah, and you wanted to win the national championship.
And I wanted to win a national title, too. I mean, I was really hungry, and I was prepped for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was mentally charged. I'm not sure there could have been anybody in the world who could have beaten me that night. Mm-hmm. I was ready.
And you believe that you could beat him. I mean, when a lot of people basically felt, like I said, he was superhuman, invincible, yeah. you didn't believe that.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And my strategy was to go out and use his strategy against him.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, he would try to out-condition his opponents, and I was going to out-condition him.
Okay.
You know, he was going to just beat on him and constantly keep him so off guard that they weren't able to do anything, and that was my strategy too, to keep him so busy that he would not be able to get into his rhythm during the match. And I think my strategy worked.
Before we turned the recorders on, we watched some, not the entire match, but clips of the match that were in this documentary. And I mean, what was it like for you? You've obviously rewatched it since then, I'm sure, a number of times. And we're talking about the match, like you just remember it, you know, even almost 50 years ago now, but it's like it just kind of burned into your memory, it seems.
Yeah, it you know, I've seen it enough times that it is burned in my memory. Yeah. I can remember almost every move that we did during that match, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. But it's really incredible to watch, even for me, not being a huge fan of wrestling or knowing that much about the sport, but you just feel it's an incredible story. It's still remembered as one of the greatest upsets in all sports. And just you can see, even again for me, not knowing necessarily exactly what I'm watching, you can see both of these incredible athletes just giving it absolutely everything that they have for nine straight minutes. You were absolutely exhausted at the end. You could tell they pulled you over for an interview, and you're just gasping for breath.
Yep, I gave it everything I had.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, describe the scene. It was just packed stadium.
Well, the stadium was packed, I wish you could have been there to listen to the crowd. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody was there anticipating Dan Gable to go out his whole career undefeated.
I believe there were like advertising campaigns and things that he was already signed on to. Yep. They were printed like 181 and zero.
Yeah. Yep, that's right. But then during the match, it was absolutely unbelievable. The only thing I can compare it to is like the old, you've seen the old movies with the Roman gladiators, you know, and crowd all the way around, these two guys duking it out down below.
Yeah.
And the roar was deafening. I mean, we couldn't hear the referee. You know, the referee had to get, you know, within a couple feet of us and yell in order for us to hear.
Yeah.
The crowd was unbelievable. I know someplace I saw that it was described as the roar of Niagara Falls.
Yeah.
And it was. It was unbelievable. The noise in there. I mean, people were cheering for me. People were cheering for him. And the match went back and forth and back and forth. Yeah. And it was an unbelievable match.
Yeah.
And after the tournament, after that match was done, after I'd beaten him, the whole tournament stopped. Hmm. I mean, it just stopped dead for about 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like, did you see what happened? Did you see it? And it was, people were scrambling around, and newspaper reporters were scrambling.
Right.
It was unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah. People were apologizing for calling you a dummy. No, just kidding.
Yeah, and I don't know how much money exchanged hands during that match, but If you'd have been a betting man, you'd have been betting on Gable, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
But at any rate, then
I think. I think I even saw it written like maybe you were the only person in that arena that thought you had a chance against it. Almost everyone was figuring this was, you know, Dan Gable had it locked up.
Yeah, so. I think my brother probably believed that I could beat him, and then maybe my coach. I don't know.
Right. So maybe a couple out of thousands.
But at any rate, you know, what's also interesting is after the match, you know, we went to the podium and was presented the awards for the different places. And when they presented Dan Gable his second place award, you know, the crowd stood up and gave him a standing ovation for that went on for like 10 minutes. Hmm. It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And he deserved it.
Yeah.
He deserved it. I mean, it was unbelievable what he had accomplished.
Yeah.
You know, it's and I kind of felt sorry that I had beaten him at that point, you know.
Yeah.
But I've talked to Dan since then, and he doesn't harbor any hard feelings, I don't think. I mean, I think he still wishes he would have won that match, but you know, I think I made him a better wrestler.
Yeah.
Because
he said that as well.
Yeah, he realized that if I could beat him, there might be somebody else out there that could also.
Yeah.
And so he doubled down on his workouts and workout partners and everything else, and I think it showed.
Yeah.
Made a big difference in how he was able to perform at the world level.
Yeah. And one thing that's really incredible, on top of even the athletic performance from both of you, but when you watch the match and read about it, is just the sportsmanship from both of you. I wonder if you remember that aspect as well. We were watching something that you wouldn't notice unless you had Larry Owens with you to point out and commentate it, but at one point in the match, I guess Dan Gable had lost a contact lens after it was over. You had seen it during the match. You went and picked it up for him. I think there was a part where you kind of helped him up, and then afterward as well, and I've seen interviews from him. I mean, there wasn't necessarily the kind of the kind of nastiness or what. I mean, he and you both had a tremendous respect for each other, and have always kind of stated that there was no kind of like, oh, he got lucky or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing, and I think quite a model for would-be and aspiring athletes for our young people today.
I know sometimes I see these athletes, when they win the match, you know, they jump up and point their finger in the air, you know, I'm number one, you know, and pound their chest and flex their muscles and everything else, or do backflips, and I just want to go down there and punch them, you know?
Or pin them, maybe.
You know, it's like, you know, why would you do that?
Mm.
You know, it just degrades the sport.
Mm.
You know, there's two people out there, and you go out and you wrestle and you do the job, and you don't belittle or degrade your opponent, whether you win or lose.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, and you know, I can tell you of an instance where that happened to me. I got second in the NCAA my junior and senior years. I didn't get first.
Hmm.
But after the, that was the, my senior year, I got second place in the NCAA. One of the other wrestlers who had placed in my weight class, and I'm not going to mention his name, but he came down to me and he pointed his finger at me and said, you know, Owings, he said, if I'd have been on your side of the bracket, I would have kicked your A double whatever.
Yeah.
And I didn't say anything, but he got a chance to do that later on that year, because at the Olympic Trials Tournament, I went back and I was actually going to go at 137 pounds, and I was within a couple pounds the night before. And then I realized that my wife was pregnant, and she didn't want me to go. She was going to have the baby at that time. And also, I was tired of being the guy that beat Dan Gable, and I thought, you know, I'll go up to 149.5. I'll wrestle Dan Gable. He'll beat me. And then everybody will leave me alone, you know? And that didn't work out.
Yeah.
But there was also this other guy that had told me he was going to kick my, you know what, in that weight class. And he got a chance to do that.
Yeah.
And I ended up beating him 18-3.
Mm.
I just pounded on him.
Yeah.
Because nobody, you don't tell your opponent that.
Yeah.
You know, that's just the wrong thing to do.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to say anything after that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I don't hear you saying that anymore.
I love it. Yeah, but just let the performance do the talking. Yeah.
So anyway, I did wrestle Dan Gable in that Olympic Trials tournament, and he beat me. Mm-hmm. I scored a point on him, and I was the only guy to score a point on him in either the Olympic Trials tournament or the Olympics. Mm-hmm. I was the only guy to even score on him. And I didn't even really want to win.
Yeah.
So if I'd really wanted to win and have been really working out, maybe I'd have done better.
Yeah.
The guy that went at 137.5 pounds in the weight class that I would have been ended up being a silver medalist that year.
Oh, cool.
And I beat him three times that same year.
Yeah.
So I think I'd have done all right.
Yeah, I'm sure you would have. It's like you kind of said at the beginning, you can do, you've learned, you can do anything that you want to if you work hard enough at it.
That's right.
But the one other part of your story, obviously the incredible achievement of being the only man to have ever beaten Dan Gable, considered the greatest wrestler in the history of the sport. And to be here from Canby, which is pretty cool, or at least Canby High School. What happened after? You know, we were kind of talking about that before we started recording as well, but the impact that, and not necessarily, at least at first, a positive impact that this amazing win had on your life and your career, and then how you managed to turn it into a positive thing in your later life.
Yeah, you know, for years I tried to hide from that, being the guy that beat Dan Gable, you know, and it did open a lot of doors in my life, you know.
Yeah.
No question about that, you know. I got some different jobs probably because of that.
I think, and I've heard you say in other interviews that you would have preferred to be known as Larry Owings, the great wrestler, not Larry Owings, the guy who beat Dan Gable.
Yes, that's correct.
And that's why I didn't necessarily want to introduce you as that, but yeah.
Yeah, but at any rate, you know, so I struggled for years with that identity problem, you know. And then it was about 10 years ago or so, I was in bed, sleeping, mm-hmm. and I
not
woke,
doing push-ups.
And no, I wasn't doing push-ups or anything. And I woke up with a start. I mean, I just woke wide awake. Mm-hmm. And this, I don't want to call it a vision or whatever you want to say, flashed into my mind, stand in sunlight if you expect to be heard. Mm-hmm. And it was so vivid that I wrote it down. I keep a little tablet by my nightstand to write things down on it. So I wrote it down on the nightstand, and it was 10 minutes after midnight. I know exactly what time it was. Mm-hmm. And I wrote it down, stand in sunlight if you expect to be heard. And it didn't say stand in sunshine, because if you stand in sunshine, you get warm. Mm-hmm. But if you stand in sunlight, you don't necessarily get warm, but you're able to be seen. Mm-hmm. And I realized then that all these years I had been hiding, kind of like my identity, and God had given me this talent in wrestling, mm-hmm. and I was trying to hide it. Mm-hmm. And I realized then that all these years that I had been struggling with that and fighting against it had done no good whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I was either destined to spend the rest of my life fighting against it, or I had to change my attitude. Mm. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to embrace this talent of wrestling that God gave me and use it for the benefit of others. Mm. And so from then on out, my attitude has kind of changed a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't feel the stress, I guess, as much with it. And I've been able to help, I can't tell you how many kids.
Oh, that's so cool.
And I've had more than one come up to me and thank me for being there and being a good role model. I particularly remember one just a few years back that he called me about a year after he was out of high school. And so, Coach, he says, I just wanted to thank you. I go, thank me? Thank me for what? He says, well, he says, you saved my life. I go, what?
Yeah.
He says, yeah. He says, I was on the wrong road. He says, I'm going down the wrong path. And he said, if it hadn't been for you and wrestling, he said, I don't know where I'd be right now. He says, right now I've got a wife and a child, and he says, I got a good job. And he says, it's all because of you. And, you know, those are the kind of things that really make you feel good about what you're doing.
Yeah, yeah, and make you believe that things do happen for a reason and that,
yep.
Yeah.
And so I think God gave me this talent in wrestling for a reason, and now it's payback time for me. So I'm coaching up at Woodburn High School still, and, you know, wherever I can help or wherever I can try to make young people better, keep them away from the video games and the drugs and the violence and the gangs and everything else, point them in the right direction, you know, that's important.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, it has been an absolute pleasure and honor to talk to you and hear some of this story, Larry. I've really enjoyed having you on the show. We're almost out of time, but I do want to give you one last chance. Just kind of going in that vein, is there anything that you'd want to put out there, maybe to young people that might be listening, or just anything else you want to share before we go?
No, just to maybe review those three things that are important in my life. You know, never quit.
Yeah.
And believe in yourself. Believe you can do it. And look for ways to help other people. Those are three important things. If you remember those three things, it'll take you a long way in life.
Cool. Well, the documentary that we've mentioned a couple times was done by a junior at Woodburn High School, Caden Christiansen.
Correct.
And it's incredible. Very, very well done. We're going to put a link out with this podcast so you guys can check that out. It goes much deeper into the story of this match and what led up to it and what you're able to use it for now, Larry. So definitely check that out if you're interested in hearing more about this really phenomenal story. Thank you, Larry Owings, for coming on the KMB Now podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad I'm able to come.
So I'm here with Derek Hill, president of Advantage Mortgage in Canby. I was wondering what's going on in the mortgage industry right now.
The mortgage industry is on fire right now. The big thing that's really exciting for us is that we are now an independent mortgage broker, which means that we can offer substantially lower rates and lower fees for our customers. For example, we just got a loan last week and the realtor said, hey, I think you should go talk to Derek at Advantage Mortgage. And sure enough, we got the borrower 3/4 better rate, and we saved them 14 grand in fees.
Cool. So where can people find you?
So office number is 503-266-5800, or they can find us on the web at findtheadvantage.com. But most people just give us a holler or they stop in.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks, Derek.
You bet. Advantage Mortgage, NMLS number 1770599. Derek Hills, NMLS number 50183. Equal housing opportunity.
The Canby Now podcast is a production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
The Canby Now podcast is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
Huge thank you as well to our supporters on Patreon. We rely on your monthly contributions to continue to do this work that we seriously love. For information on how you can become one of the coolest people in the world, a patron of the Canby Now podcast, visit canbynowpod.com/plus.